Today's episode of Expanded Perspectives is sponsored by Gaia.com. Help find your own truth by exploring perspectives you won't find in the mainstream on some of life's biggest mysteries. Whether it's grand conspiracies, breakaway societies, UFOs, ancient civilizations, lost wisdom, as well as the paranormal, all at your fingertips. Stream videos anywhere from your living room or on the go with access to over 7,000 titles, all available to you with a monthly plan for only $9.95 a month. If you sign up now, the first month is only 99 cents. And there are multiple plans to choose from, including a three-month plan and an annual plan. If you enjoy expanding your perspective, then you'll enjoy Gaia.com. Gaia.com. Gaia.com.
Out there, friends, and thanks again for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives. I am Cam Hale, and as always, sitting across the table from me, y'all all know him. If you don't, you really don't want to know him, but I mean, he's in here with me nonetheless, is the champion at 145 and 155 pounds of podcasting, which that's not even close. He probably weighed 145 pounds whenever you was like six. But anyhow, it's Kyle Filio Wilson.
How's it going, everybody? I'm glad to be here in Skeleton Studios. No, I do not weigh 155, but no, I didn't. Man, when I graduated high school, I think I only weighed like 138 pounds.
Wow.
So it's crazy, right? 20 years later.
238. No, I'm kidding, folks.
I'm about 190, I think, now. So
we had, when we kicked this thing off, you can't help, folks. I know a lot of you are probably have no clue and don't care about knowing what MMA is, but for those of you that do, if you watch the fights this weekend, hats off to Conor McGregor and all you Irish fans, everybody, wow, that man is...
It's impressive, right?
Look, you can hate on him for the things he says, but you cannot hate on him for his performance. He is unbelievable.
It's pretty amazing watching him work.
Man, and I hope everybody... Misha Tate retired. Misha, thank you so much for the fun. Thank you so much for the fights. It's a bummer, but, you know, she's a beautiful woman. She can go make money doing something else and not get beat up. But everybody else, I hope Chris Weidman's okay. There was some good fights, folks.
It was pretty good.
Really good fights. I know everybody complains, I know we do over here too, about this time change. Everybody complains about the time change. I'm not a fan. You're not a fan. Everything, you know, you kind of get stuck in that whole deal. And it's always the first couple of weeks seems to throw you off track. It does me.
Does me, yeah.
Well, I got to looking in, and I was just looking at good night sleeps and things, you know, a while back, just prodding around this weekend, trying to find something, because I'm like, man, is there any way to better your sleep? And I come across this actually in the news, and this is a recent report. This comes from The Guardian, folks. For those of you that are having a problem sleep and you want a good night's sleep, written here says, spend less time with your phone.
Yeah, I can believe that.
I can completely believe that. Now, I know we've discussed it before about things and the way it can interrupt your sleep patterns, but they've actually gone and done a big study on it now. And when I say they, in air quotes, it's Gregory Marcus. He's the co-author of this research, and he's from the University of California there in San Francisco. And one of his quotes from this Guardian article says that the more screen time, the worse the quality of sleep. Now, Simon Archer is an expert in sleep science from the University of Surrey. And he even goes on to say that I think there's quite a lot of data now showing that these electronic devices being used at night is a problem. Now, he goes on to say this. A lot of these devices emit quite a bit of blue light. And it's the blue light which is a particular problem because that suppresses the hormone melatonin. You know, and people have always talked about taking it.
Yeah. Do you go
I've
sleep?
Taken it in the past. Yeah. Now, he says that the melatonin begins to rise a few hours before sleep onset, and it's kind of like your body's signal to get ready for sleep. And I can understand that. It's kind of the way when people start yawning, you're like, man, is it bedtime? You're getting tired? Your body knows, so it slowly starts producing that. It says here that blue light, this is Archer talking, also has an alerting effect on the brain. And then that's where it causes it, because it has the content of this comes in from like emails and things like that, and basically it reverses what your melatonin is doing, the right, light that this phone's emitting. They've even published this, that you can go into the journals. There's a bunch of journals from the University of California that talk about it, but there's a lot of things. But in this study, and the total, it says they were 653 adults completed this study of this, and they used this app. And they use this app for like 30 days. And this and it's some crazy, but it's the study's called the Health eHeart. But out of those 653 adults, says that the average participant spent 3.7 minutes every hour using their smartphones. All right. The younger people says, and you know, they spent longer on average than their phone. So you're talking about some younger groups of people. It did, of course, more than that. But this is it. Further analysis, you're going to enjoy this. 136 of the participants revealed that longer screen time was linked to fewer hours of shut-eye and lower proportion of time spent in bed asleep. On average, every extra minute of time individuals spent on their phone was linked to a decrease in sleep duration of approximately 5 minutes.
Yeah, I can believe that.
So it's a 5-to-1. If you're on there, you're talking about... That's a large number. It's not like it's a 1-for-1. Oh, I don't sleep well. 1 minute I'm on. When you're giving up a 5-to-1 odds, you don't bet on that.
Yeah. Does it say if there's any propensity for women over men or the vice
versa? There's a lot of data, and I'm not going to get into that. That's all on you. It's www. No, here we go. If you want to send it, expandedperspectives@yahoo.com. Ladies, go ahead and direct all your hate towards Kyle.
No, I'm not hating. I'm just interested because look, I don't use my phone that much, but my wife is exact opposite. She's always on her phone. And to me, but I'm guilty of probably being on the computer all the time. She's very rarely on the computer. She uses her phone for everything. I'm on the computer late at night all the time, whether it's researching, editing, emailing.
But when you do leave it and go and just sit, you actually walk away from it.
I do, yeah.
Well, see, that's what they're talking about is getting in bed and then getting on your phone.
Yeah, it's real easy to do. It's easy to get sucked in. You know, you're looking at Instagram photos or you're reading an article and then you get... You can very easily be like, crap, I've been looking at this for an hour.
Well, the funny thing is you know what we always laugh about because your wife, my daughter, they love Pinterest, right? Yeah. They're Pinterest crazy. That's what the one thing that they're talking about is a disruptive effect from engaging websites and apps like Facebook, Instagram, Pinterest, all these. Yeah. That's kind of what they're going through is they're like, that's where it comes from. If you were just looking at normal websites, you get bored.
Yeah.
But when you're engaging back and forth, it's like playing a game laying in bed.
I will say this. I don't look at Pinterest or anything, but I do like Pinterest because my wife has created several new recipes from Pinterest, and man, they're amazing.
Was it the old joke that one has posted? It's like, awesome. Your wife's been on Pinterest for 8 hours. Now you're eating salad out of a mason jar. That's cool. But anyway, folks, if you want better sleep, turn the phone off.
Yeah, right.
Just leave it off. You know, and people will be like, just turn it off. Power it down. And if they can't handle that, you got to remember, all of us, when I say all of us, everyone my age, Kyle's age, all of us, we didn't even have these when we was growing up.
Yeah,
if you didn't reach me at the house, you just didn't reach me.
Right. I kind of like that a little better.
Yes.
You know, anyways, but check this out. This is pretty cool. This is about a great flying saucer mystery of 1966.
Hey-o!
And most people aren't aware of this, but on a quiet day in March in 1966, 7 eyewitnesses reported an unidentified flying object maneuvering over Livingston and Washtenaw counties in Michigan. But these weren't just ordinary people, Cam. These were police officers, sheriff deputies, and over 100 other people. And of course, an official investigation was declared, and they sent out J. Allen Hynek, remember him? And he researched it and stuff. And then the official result of his findings was that it was just swamp gas. Now, the people that are interviewed are saying that that is ridiculous. Let's listen to this.
In Spielberg's sci-fi spectacular, UFOs speed through the skies of Indiana. In hot pursuit are local law enforcement officers. Surely a Hollywood fantasy. In fact, it's a scene that could have been directly lifted from the files of Project Blue Book.
The great flying saucer mystery of 1966 began here, near Dexter, Michigan, late in March. No one photographed it, but Sergeant Newell Schneider of the Sheriff's Office remembered it well enough to draw it.
No, it moved very rapidly. If I could change and go to the right or the left or go crossways without hesitating a bit.
What do you think it was?
Well, if they call it a flying saucer, that's what it is.
50 years later, Sergeant Newell Schneider is now retired, but remains convinced of his sightings of UFOs over the Michigan skies.
And I was a sergeant, worked for Washtenaw County Sheriff Department in 1966. My partner and I, David Fitzpatrick, was on road patrol, and we looked in the sky, and we seen three objects up there. And my partner and I was wondering what was going on, and we just kept seeing them. And we notified Milan police, and they had also spotted the same objects. To us, it looked like a cigar-shaped object. with multiple lights, tremendous speed. This was not man-made aircraft because you just couldn't believe how fast it would move up, down, sideways.
Douglas Harvey, Washtenaw County's former sheriff, remembers the event vividly.
During that week, we received a call that a gentleman out on McGinnis Road observed a flying saucer type of a thing in his backyard. This was a very moderate family, and they're not the type to go out and look for publicity. In fact, they didn't want the notoriety at all. We're talking about something unknown. You know, it didn't propose a threat of any type, so there was no safety precautions other than to try to find out what it was.
Dr. Hynek agreed that the good citizens of Michigan had seen something in the marshlands. He thought they had seen marsh gas.
The illusion of motion frequently is given by the fact that a little bit of swamp light appears here, it goes out, another one appears over here, that goes out, but the illusion as viewed from a distance is that the objects have moved back and forth.
As far as swamp gas, I'm sorry that we was told we seen swamp gas, but that kind of hurt. It gave us a complex that we was telling the truth. We were. I mean, I can honestly say that. My partner and I seen a UFO.
But some suspect that Hynek never believed in the swamp gas theory himself. Many believe the government spin doctors were at work, and Hynek was simply told to sell the theory.
When Hynek got over at first sight, he looked out there and he told me personally that he had no idea what it was. Then he got on the telephone and was talking to Washington. And right after that phone call, I didn't hear the conversation, but after the phone call, I got back in my car and explained that I got bad news for you. He said, your men see nothing but swamp gas.
And of course, the sheriff said, you got to be joking. And Dr. Hynek says, no. He says, that's what I'm told to tell everybody in the conversation.
So there you go. That is from some of the actual eyewitnesses. And one of the guys says in that little clip that he saw J. Allen Hynek on the phone with the government, and they told him that it was only swamp gas, and that's what he's supposed to tell. And he told the sheriff that, and the sheriff was like, that's impossible. And J. Allen Hynek just said, you know what? That's what they told me to tell everybody, so that's what it is. It's swamp gas. So you know, tongue in cheek, that's not what it is. This seems to be a cover-up that's continued to this day. Very interesting. The Great Flying Saucer Mystery of 1966. I love those types of things.
I'm a huge fan of all the old school stuff like you're talking about, but I got something you're going to be a huge fan of.
Let's hear it.
All right. You know, we're going to try to plan to go to Florida in the summer, right? We want to go down and go fishing, kayak fishing and all this stuff. And y'all know how I feel about that. But I know how much Kyle loves lake monsters. He loves sea creatures. He loves all this stuff. This comes from our amigos at Cryptozoology News, folks. Yeah. New Smyrna Beach. Smyra. I don't know what you people are writing down. I don't even know how you pronounce that. Anyway, there's a beach in Florida. New Smyra, I'm going to go with. Smyrna. This is this. A Nessie-like creature was spotted in Florida. A man said he and his family members saw a dinosaur-like animal at a fishing spot in Florida. And no, Kyle, it wasn't your mother. She was here in Weatherford. Stephen Smith, 31 years old, said he was fishing with his cousins when they came upon the unknown creature. Now, this is what he told Cryptozoology News this past Saturday. We approached the drop-off to the open area where we were going to fish, and as we approached, I caught sight of the animal. It looked like the Loch Ness Monster. It was facing generally away from us, but at an angle to where I could see its left side. It was plain as day. As soon as it realized we were there, it dove down its head to the right, and that's when I caught sight of its tail and rear flipper. He describes the animal as a jet black plesiosaurus with bloodshot round eyes and an S-shaped, long, stocky, strong neck. This is what he says. It had thick tail and flippers, about 3 to 4 foot tall. Its swimming ability was weird. Never seen anything stop like that so abruptly and cause such a ruckus. Scared the crap out of me to want to go back away from the water. He said, just like Nessie. Now, in the sighting, he's reported that there's about 3 seconds. He said the eyewitnesses didn't have any photographs, any videos. That's just what they saw. And then, of course, you know, he goes in, they start talking about some other stuff where they saw this, like a dragon down there in 2005 or 2015. They saw one here in Texas and all this stuff. So you get into that. Like, look, I don't know what he saw. But when you see a 3-second sighting, don't you think that you could easily misidentify something in 3 seconds?
Absolutely. I mean, it could be a manatee or something like that. I mean,
yeah.
You know,
I'm not saying that's not what he saw.
I'm not saying that either.
I don't know what he saw, but it's one of those. If it would have said, look, the sighting lasted 15, even 20 seconds, for some reason I'm better than that than with something for 3 seconds. Because to be honest, I've had something fly by me, and you're like, when I was at work. And you're like, oh, what was that? Was that a wasp? What was that? And it turns out it's just a moth. Or it's just a shadow of a bird flying over you. And it's something, and that's in just a few seconds.
Just a few seconds.
And you just catch a glimpse out of it. So it's hard to say he didn't, because we weren't there. But 3 seconds worth of a sighting, and you think you saw something that looks like Nessie. And I'm kind of like, listen here, Florida man. I don't know what's going on, bro, but
I agree with you. It's very difficult. Yeah. Same thing happens with these like blob squatches. You see these photographs or videos of something moving in the forest, and they're like, that's it. That's it. And I'm like, look, I want to believe you. And I'm sure you being there, you get to see it better than it looks like on this film. But so many times I've seen stuff like that, and I'm like, man, I saw something move, but I can't definitively say what it is. You saw something in the water and it had a flipper and it had a tail. Well, guess what? There's lots of things in the ocean that have flippers and tails and that are large.
Most everything in the ocean has a flipper or tail of some sort.
You know what I'm saying? And so if you're not a marine biologist or something, you might accidentally misidentify something. I don't think the person's outright lying. I'm thinking it's probably misidentification. Or it was a plesiosaur.
Or it goes back into what you and I talked about before. Like what you're saying is they feel like they had that sighting. So it's just like having the real sighting. Whether it was really a plesiosaur or completely misidentified, they feel like they had that sighting. So it does the same thing.
Yeah, exactly. Well, check this out. This comes over from Phantoms and Monsters. It's pretty cool. And Lon posted over there this incredible interview that was conducted by a researcher years ago about the Roswell crash. He talks about how a guy one day in 1970, a maintenance worker, a guy I knew from church, came into my lab and said that he had a friend of his that wanted to talk to me about something, but he didn't want to meet in a public place. So I told him, well, tell the guy to come to my house. We can do it at my home. So he did. And at the time, I didn't know that the guy wanted to tell me about a UFO incident. He just said he wanted to speak with me. The individual I interviewed was a welder by trade, and after the war was employed at the Roswell Air Force Base, welding jigs and fixtures for servicing aircraft. He began by stating that the week before the 4th of July, flying saucers would fly over the base in pairs every once in a while. He said they were circular and had a large dome on the top. They were flat on the bottom and were always silent. He assumed they were some technology obtained by the Germans. He said everyone working there called them flats. He said he had just returned back to work after the 4th of July holiday when a truck pulled up and an officer got out and told him to load a cutting torch and take some fresh tanks and that they were going out into the desert. He said that it was mid-afternoon when they arrived at the crash site. He said at the time he thought a plane had gone down. He said they had a flatbed truck loaded with wreckage, and there were soldiers on their hands and knees picking up every piece of wreckage and putting it in cloth bags. He said the bags were the kind used for sandbags. He said they drove a little farther out of sight from the wreckage and came upon a second group of people standing around and a completely intact UFO. He said the brush was knocked down, indicating the craft had skidded across the ground and came to rest, nosed into a natural berm with the backside slightly off the ground. He described the craft as being 25 to 26 feet in diameter with a large dome on top. He said the craft was the color of weak tea with a burnished finish. He said there were no signs of weld marks, seams, or rivets, and that all the edges had either an inside or outside radius. There were no visible windows or openings. That was why he was brought there. He was told to cut an opening in the big dome enough for a man to crawl through. By this time, it was getting to be late afternoon, and there were soldiers setting up a bank of portable lights. He said he began cutting a hole from the base of the dome. He said it was a tough alloy and slow cutting, but the material was surprisingly thin. He tried bending the metal out of his way as he was cutting, but the metal would always spring back to its original shape without any creasing. He finished his cut and set the metal piece aside and looked into the cockpit for a few seconds before he was ordered off the craft. He said it was difficult to see very far into the craft because of the glare from the portable lights, and the cockpit was full of smoke from the cutting torch. He said he saw two beings who appeared to be dead. He said the cockpit had a strong smell of ammonia. He described the two beings as being about 4 foot tall, but they were doubled up, so it was hard to say. They were wearing what he said were skin-tight, purplish flight suits that reminded him of sequins. He described their heads as what we now refer to as grays. He said there were no visible instruments that he could see. He was ordered off the craft with his gear, and then he was returned to the airbase. He said it was dark when they arrived, and he was escorted by armed guards into a building for debriefing. He said there were several high-ranking officers at the table, with 4 or 5 civilians in suits. He said that after he was debriefed, he was told that he was not to talk about what he had seen. It was a state secret, and if he was caught divulging anything, he would spend the rest of his life in prison, or even worse. He was scared to death by the threat, and my friend and myself are the only people who have ever told that was 23 years after the event. When we started the interview, I was told by him not to take notes or to use a recorder. He was very nervous telling me the story and had to be reassured by my friend that I would not betray him. He said that what had been described at the Roswell event was not true, and he wanted the truth told after his death. He asked that I keep what I told him a secret until after he died, which I have done. He and my friend both have passed away in the late 1980s. When I heard this story, I didn't know what to think. My friend said this guy was the real thing, and during the interview, I never sensed anything odd about his presentation or with any of his mannerisms. He proved a lot more information that I've stated, but the interview was almost 50 years ago. Some of it I've actually forgotten. I think he was telling me the truth. My friend was a very honorable and trustworthy man who would knowingly not support a man with a bogus story. I never spoke to the welder again after that evening. I've shared my knowledge of this interview with a couple investigators, but I think they've doubted my credibility. Now, if that's a true story, what that guy saw, that is incredible.
Yeah,
right?
That's awesome.
And
it goes back to a lot of the stories with the bendable metal and all.
It does. And just the fact of why would you want to meet a person, Cam, tell them the story, but then say, hey, look, don't tell anybody till after I'm dead.
Yeah, exactly.
Just on a whim, you're going to pull a massive troll like that? I mean,
it's I'm
just,
going
I
to. Mean,
I don't know. Right, you're going to. But I don't know, man. I just those kind of stories to me always seem credible. Very interesting. After the break, we're going to stick with cryptozoology, and I'm going to be talking about one of the world's most famous stories, the Jersey Devil. Stay with us, folks. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives. Texas is my home. I was born and raised here, but my family is from New Jersey. My parents, looking for work and a cheaper place to live, moved to Texas in the early 70s. My mother had an uncle who was in the military and was stationed in Texas. He found a woman and married and stayed permanently. My parents, they came down for a visit one time. They liked what they saw, and they decided to move on down. As a young boy, we would often travel back to New Jersey during the summers to visit family and friends, and that's when I was first introduced to the legend of the Jersey Devil. I don't quite remember if it was my father or my uncle that told me about the story, but I remember being intrigued. This was probably my first cryptid. My uncle claimed he saw it one time while hunting in the Pine Barrens. I was terrified. Now, 30 years later, I'm still interested in the story. Is it real? or merely urban legend. Who knows? Perhaps there is still something lurking the deep and dark forest of southern New Jersey. First off, I don't think the average person realizes how big the Pine Barrens truly are. The Pine Barrens are huge, more than 1.1 million acres, and is part of the Pinelands National Reserve, which ranges from northern Ocean County, south, and to the west, and occupies 22% of New Jersey's land area. It is the largest body of open space on the mid-Atlantic seaboard between Richmond, Virginia, and Boston, Massachusetts, covering vast areas in Ocean, Burlington, Camden, Cape May, Cumberland, and Gloucester, and Atlantic counties. About 45%, or 493,000 acres, are publicly owned. Much of that area is used by hunters, and hunters are the group with perhaps the most sightings. The legend has been told and retold to generation after generation for over the last 260 years. During that time, more than 2,000 sightings have been made. Most people think the story is a complete fabrication, but those who have actually had a sighting know it's real. There are many different versions of the birth of the New Jersey Devil, and no one can agree on the actual birthplace of the devil, but the circumstances in which it was born are pretty consistent. Most involve some sort of deal with the devil himself, or some sort of punishment placed on the mother of the beast. One of the most popular legends says a Miss Shrouds of Leeds Point, New Jersey, made a wish that if she ever had another child, she wanted it to be the devil. She wanted her child to be the most powerful force on earth and struck some kind of strange pact with Satan himself. Her next child was born, misshapen and deformed. She sheltered it in her house so the other people in the neighborhood wouldn't be able to see him. On a stormy night, it said, the child flapped its arms and attached to them were leathery bat-like wings. The creepy monstrosity escaped out the chimney and was never seen by the family again. Another story that also placed the birth at Leeds Point said that a young girl fell in love with a British soldier during the Revolutionary War. The people of Leeds Point cursed her, and when she gave birth, she had a devil. Some people believe the birth of the devil was punishment for the mistreatment of a minister by the Leeds folk. Another story placed the birth in Estelville, New Jersey. Miss Leeds of Estelville, finding out she was pregnant with her 13th child, shouted, "I hope it's a devil!" She got her wish. The child was born with horns, a tail, wings, and even an horse-like head. The creature revisited Miss Leeds every day. She stood at her door and told it to leave. After a while, the creature got the hint and never returned. Burlington, New Jersey, also claims to be the birthplace of the Jersey Devil. In 1735, Mother Leeds was in labor on a stormy night. Gathered around her were her friends and family. Mother Leeds was supposedly a witch, and the child's father was the devil himself. The child was born normal, but then it changed form. It changed from a normal baby to a creature with hooves, a horse's head, bat wings, and a forked tail. It beat up everybody present and flew up the chimney. It circled the villages and headed towards the pines. In 1740, a clergy exorcised the devil for over 100 years, and it wasn't seen again until 1890. Now, there are many versions of this legend. The legends say that it was the 6th, the 8th, the 10th, 12th, or even the 13th child. It was born normal or deformed, and the mother confined it to the cellar or in the attic. Now, although there are many discrepancies in all these stories, there are three pieces of evidence that tie all of the legends of the Jersey Devil's origin together. The first thing that ties the legends together is the name Leeds. Whether the mother's name was Leeds or the birthplace was Leeds Point, all of the stories include the name Leeds. Alfred Heston, the Atlantic County historian, believes that the devil could be a Leeds or a Shroud's baby. He discovered that a Daniel Leeds opened land in the Great Egg Harbor in New Jersey in 1699. His family lived in Leeds Point. He also discovered a Samuel Shrouds Sr., who came to Little Egg Harbor, New Jersey in 1735 and lived right across the river from the house of Mother Leeds. The third fact ties in the Burlington story with the other stories. Professor Fred McFadden of Coppin State College, Baltimore, found that a devil was mentioned in writings from Burlington as early as 1735. The sightings have been divided into three time periods: pre-1909, January 16th through January 23rd, 1909, and then post-1909. From the pre-1909 era, few documented recordings of sightings still exist, and the ones that do confirm the existence of the devil. In the early 19th century, Commodore Stephen Decatur, who was a naval hero, was testing cannonballs on the firing range when he saw a strange creature flying across the sky. He fired and hit the creature, but it kept right on flying across the field. In another's tale, Joseph Bonaparte, former King of Spain and brother of Napoleon, saw the Jersey Devil in Bordentown, New Jersey, between 1816 and 1839, both times while he was hunting. In 1840 and in 1841, many sheep and chickens were killed by the creature with a piercing scream and strange tracks. In 1859 through 1894, the Jersey Devil was seen, and numerous times it reportedly carried off anything that moved in Haddonfield, Bridgeton, Smithville, Long Branch, Brigantine, and Leeds Point. W.F. Mayer of New York noticed while visiting the Pine Barrens, most of the locals would not venture out after dark. The devil was sighted by George Serossi, a prominent businessman at the New Jersey-New York border. This was the last reported sighting before the turn of the century. In 1903, Charles Skinner, author of American Myths and Legends, claimed that the legend of the devil had run its course, and that in the new century, New Jersey would hear no more of this devil. New Jersey rested easy with that for 6 years, until the week of January 16th through January 23rd, 1909. You see, during this week, the devil would leave his tracks all over southern New Jersey and Philadelphia. It was during this time that he was seen by over 1,000 people, and this was his largest appearance ever. It all started early Sunday morning, January 16th, 1909. Thack Cousins of Woodbury, New Jersey, saw a flying creature with glowing eyes slowly drifting down the street. In Bristol, Pennsylvania, John McCohen heard and saw the strange creature on the banks of the canal. A pastor named James Saxville fired at the creature as it flew away screaming. E.W. Minister, postmaster of Bristol, Pennsylvania, also saw a bird-like creature with a horse's head, and he claimed that it had a piercing scream. When daylight came, the residents of Bristol found hoof prints in the snow. Two local trappers said they have never seen tracks like those ever before. On Monday, the Loudons of Burlington, New Jersey, found hoof prints in their yard and around their trash, which was half eaten. Almost every yard in Burlington had these strange hoof prints in them. The prints even went up trees, went from roof to roof, and sometimes disappeared in the middle of a road, and stopped sometimes in the middle of open fields. The same tracks were also found in Columbus, Heading, Kenhora, and Rancocas. A hunt was organized to follow the tracks, but the dogs wouldn't follow the trail. On the 19th, the Jersey Devil made his longest appearance of the week. At around 2:30 a.m., Mr. and Miss Nelson Evans of Gloucester were awakened by a strange noise. They watched this devil from their window for about 10 minutes. Mr. Evans described the creature that they saw. He said it was about 3.5 feet high, with a head like a collie dog and a face like a horse. It had a long neck, wings about 2 feet long, and its back legs were like those of a crane. And, of course, it had horse's hooves. It walked on its back legs and held up 2 short front legs with paws on them. It didn't use the front legs at all while we were watching. My wife and I were scared, I tell you, but I managed to open the window and say, "Shoo, get out of here." And it turned around and barked at me and then flew away. Tuesday afternoon, 2 professional hunters tracked the devil for 20 miles in Gloucester. The trail jumped 5-foot fences. It went under 8-inch spaces. The hoof prints were found in more parts of South Jersey. A group of observers in Camden, New Jersey, saw the devil, and it barked at them, they said, and then took off into the air. The next day, a Burlington police officer and a Reverend John Purcell of Pemberton saw the Jersey Devil. Reverend Purcell said, "I never saw anything like it before." Posses in Haddonfield found tracks that ended abruptly. In Collingsworth, New Jersey, a posse watched the devil fly off toward Moorestown. Near Moorestown, John Smith of Mapleshade saw the devil at the Mount Carmel Cemetery. George Snyder saw the devil right after Mr. Smith, and their descriptions were identical. In Riverside, New Jersey, hoof prints were found on rooftops and also around a dead puppy. On Thursday, the Jersey Devil was seen by the Black Hawk Social Club. He was also seen by a trolley full of people in Clementon as it circled above them. The people just watched in awe. They couldn't tell what this was they were looking at. Was it a small dragon? Was it a prehistoric dinosaur? Was it some kind of unknown bird? They couldn't decide. The witnesses' descriptions matched the others from the days before. In Trenton, Councilman E.P. Whedon heard the flapping of wings and then found hoof prints outside his door. The prints were also found at the arsenal in Trenton. As the day wore on, the trolleys in Trenton and New Brunswick had armed drivers to ward off any potential attacks. The people in Pittman filled the churches. Chickens had been missing all week throughout the Delaware Valley, but when the farmers checked their yards that day, they found their chickens dead with no marks on them. The West Collingwood's fire department fired their hose at the devil. The devil retreated at first, but then charged and flew away at the last second. Later that night, Miss Sobrinsky of Camden heard a commotion in her yard. She opened her door to see the Jersey Devil standing there with her dog in its grip. Frightened, she hit the devil with a broom until it let go of her dog, then it flew away. She started screaming until her neighbors came over. 2 police officers arrived at her house, where over 100 people had begun to gather. The crowd heard a scream coming from Kagan Hill. The mob ran toward the creature, and there it was on top of the hill. The police shot at it, and the devil flew off into the night. The streets of Camden were empty after that. On Friday, Camden police officer Lewis Sterer saw the devil drinking from a horse's trough. The school in Mount Ephraim was closed because no students came in. Mills and factories in Gloucester and Haynesport had to close also because none of the employees came to work. Many New Jersey residents wouldn't even leave their houses, even in the daylight. Officer Merchant of Blackwood drew a sketch of the creature that he saw. His sketch coincided with the descriptions from earlier in the week. A man named Jacob Henderson claims that he saw the devil in Salem and described it as having wings and a tail. The devil was only seen once more in 1909, in February. And since 1909, the Jersey Devil has continued to be sighted by people all over New Jersey. The number of sightings that have been reported to the authorities has dwindled over the years. Perhaps the creature is no longer alive, or perhaps people aren't coming forward for fear of ridicule or being called crazy. Despite the lower amount of sightings, they do still occur continuously since 1909, although more sporadically, there are still sightings. In 1927, a cab driver on his way to Salem got a flat tire. He stopped to fix the tire. As he was doing this, some creature that stood upright, was covered with hair, landed on the roof of his cab. The creature shook his car violently. He was terrified. He fled the scene, leaving the tire and the jack behind. Philip Smith, who was known as a sober and honest man, saw the devil walking down the street in 1953. The characteristic screams of the Jersey Devil were heard in the woods near Woodstown, New Jersey, in 1936. Again, around 1961, two couples were parked in a car in the Pine Barrens. They heard a loud screeching noise outside. Suddenly, they claimed the roof of the car was smashed in. They fled the scene, but did return later. Again, they heard the loud screech. They saw a creature, they said, flying along the trees, taking out huge chunks of bark as it went along. In 1966, a farm was raided and 31 ducks, 3 geese, 4 cats, and 2 dogs were all killed. One of the dogs was a large dog. It was a German Shepherd. It had its throat ripped completely out. In 1981, a young couple spotted the devil at Atzian Lake in Atlantic County. In 1987, in Vinland, an aggressive German Shepherd was found torn apart and the body gnawed upon. The body was located 25 feet from the chain which had been hooked onto him. Around the body, once again, were strange hoof-like tracks that no one could identify. Over the years, there's been several theories as to what the Jersey Devil could be. One theory is that the Jersey Devil is simply a bird. Miss Cassidy of Clayton thought it was an invasion of scrowfoot ducks. Now, the scrowfoot duck is much too small to be mistaken for the devil. Others believe the devil is really just a sandhill crane. The crane used to live in South Jersey until it was pushed out by man. The sandhill crane weighs about 12 pounds, stands about 4 foot high, and has a wingspan of around 80 inches. It avoids man if it can, but if confronted, the bird will fight. It has a loud scream, a whooping-like voice that can be heard at some distance. This could account for the screams heard by witnesses. The crane also eats potatoes and corn. Now, this could account for the raids on some of the farmers' crops. But this theory doesn't explain, however, the killing of livestock, the killing of large dogs, and things like that. It also doesn't explain why people describe the devil as having a horse's head, bat wings, and a long forked tail, which all of this a crane doesn't have. Professor Bauhoff said the tracks were made by some prehistoric animal, perhaps, from the Jurassic period. He believes that these creatures survived underground in a cavern, and an expert from the Smithsonian Institute even had a theory about an ancient creature, such as a pterosaur or something, surviving underground. He said that the Jersey Devil was probably a still-living pterodactyl. Now, the Academy of Natural Sciences could find no record of any creature, living or extinct, that resembles the Jersey Devil's description. Only a small amount of the sightings and footprints could be hoaxes. The Jersey Devil has been seen by reliable people such as police, government officials, postmasters, businessmen, firemen, and other people whose integrity is beyond question. As for the hoof prints, even if some of them were hoaxes, there's still no way to explain most of the tracks, especially the ones on top of roofs. Also those that end abruptly in the middle of the field as if a creature took flight. The last theory, in my opinion, is probably the most controversial one. Many people believe that the Jersey Devil could be the very essence of evil, embodied. It is said that the devil is an uncanny harbinger of war and appears just before any great conflict. There's claims that the Jersey Devil was sighted before the start of the Civil War. It was also seen right before the Spanish-American War and World War I in 1939, before the start of World War II. And Mount Holy citizens were awakened by the noise of hooves on their rooftops. The devil was also seen December 7th, 1941. That's right, the same day Pearl Harbor was bombed. He was also seen right before the Vietnam War. The Jersey Devil's habit of being a forerunner to wars could be because of his possible demonic origins. In 1730, Ben Franklin reported a story about witchcraft and a trial that happened near Mount Holly, New Jersey. And one of the original legends says that Mother Leeds was a witch. The devil's birth could have been a result of some type of witch's curse. Other facts support the supernatural theory are the reports of the death of the devil. Remember, when Commodore Decatur fired a cannonball at the devil, he claimed that it went right through him and that the devil was unaffected. So, with all of these sightings, I suppose that a good majority of them probably could be just misidentification. Some could even be hoaxes. But for 260 years and over 2,000 sightings, they can't all be fake. So what is it that people are seeing? Is there something out there still? Or is this something that died off years ago? One thing for sure, people are still claiming to see the Jersey Devil. I know my uncle told me that he saw it. I'm not sure if he was just pulling my leg as a small boy, or if he really seen something out there. If you're ever out hiking, hunting, or just sightseeing in southern New Jersey, in the Pine Barrens, if I was you, I wouldn't stay out after dark. And we're back with Expanded Perspectives. The Jersey Devil. This is something I've been told since I was a little kid. And it's right. I can't believe we've never done an actual full-length show on it. But we have now. And it's something that people always ask me about. It's like, why did you never do that? Do you have any something against the story? I don't. And it's really interesting to me because, like I was saying in the beginning of the segment, I don't think most people realize how big and thick the Pine Barrens are. They're huge.
Yeah.
It's very big, 1.1 million acres of solid.
Jeez.
Nobody lives there. There's no houses or just fire lanes cut in case there's a forest fire or something. I've been there several times hunting. It's an incredible place, but over 2,000 sightings of this thing in the last 260 years. Obviously, some of them are hoaxes. Obviously, like we were talking about at the beginning with the plesiosaur sighting.
Yeah.
Obviously, some of them are probably misidentifications. But out of all those, can all of them be you know, fake. I don't think so. I think that this is a story. Very interesting. Now, what could it be with the horse head and the hooves and things like that? I don't know, because there definitely was sightings throughout time on people's rooftops, out in the middle of fields where the hoof prints just stopped, like something took off. There's been livestock killed, dogs killed, chickens killed, ducks, things like that. I don't know what it is. And there's several theories out there. Some have even claimed that people are imagining this, that it's not really physical, that maybe a Sasquatch or something else is responsible. Maybe it's a chupacabra. People have said that because they say the Jersey Devil is very familiar with some of the descriptions of the chupacabra. I don't know. It's a famous case. It's very interesting. I still have family members in New Jersey. They constantly ask me why I never do the Jersey Devil. I will say, though, my uncle, the one that claimed to have had a sighting, he actually seemed pretty shook up about it when he told me the story.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he was pulling my leg. And this was a guy that was in the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
I mean, he's seen some stuff to be scared. He won't go out in those woods at night.
Well, it
must have shook him, you know?
I always wonder, it's just like what we discussed in the news segment. We always talk about, well, what could it be that you were misidentifying?
I don't know.
And I could understand if it was a large bird, you know, like we always talk about. You could understand if it was something in flight. It was something along those lines that you could easily misidentify. Even if they was talking about there was an area that maybe it was an overabundance of a certain Sasquatch sighting, and you knew that area was prominent for bear and things, you could easily see how somebody could misidentify things like that. But when you look back to go, okay, what are they misidentifying? And, you know, you're talking about, what, over 2,000 sightings over the last 200 years.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, then, how are the same people, of course, I understand, there's always a way. Crazy people are always going to be just, oh, they saw it, I'm going to say I saw the same thing. I get all that, but let's throw that, just devil's advocate, let's play this. How can that many people misidentify something close enough to be mistaken for the Jersey Devil?
Yeah, that's my point exactly.
Does it become every time, and I hate to go down these paths because I hate to be the guy that always, we talk about this. Is there certain areas in the world that's got a thin film, not just in reality, but in where we live, where they cross back and forth? It seems that way, right?
Yeah, it does.
And I think that may be, that's one of the only things that I could imagine that answer for. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think the world is far more mysterious and strange than we can possibly imagine.
Yeah.
And so there's just things out there that you just have to say, look, man, I don't know what they've seen, but people have seen some weird stuff.
Yeah.
And just leave it at that.
Just leave it. Right? Well, sometimes, you're right, sometimes things aren't meant to be explained. I had this discussion with a coworker a few weeks ago. It's like, you know what? Some questions just don't have any answers.
No, man, that's just the way it is.
That's just how it is. Like, I can't help you. Just some of those questions. And you know what? I'm okay with that. Yeah. I like living in that kind of world.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it wouldn't be fun if you knew the answers to everything.
No.
There wouldn't be no mystery, right?
Yeah.
That's what makes, when you see a child, that's what's so cool about children is that they don't, the world is still so full of wonder to them.
Yeah.
And I think we lose sight of that as we get older. Before we get out of here, I'd like to talk about our sponsor, Gaia.com. Very interesting website. What it is it's a streaming service, and they have videos and documentaries and films and do-it-yourself, like yoga classes and things like that. But my favorite part is the Seeking the Truth, these mysteries and conspiracies. They got over 7,000 titles over there, and they're adding new ones on the reg. Every day, they're adding new ones up there. And I recently watched one very cool. I think I've mentioned it before, but I'm still intrigued by it. It's called The Secret, Evidence That We Are Not Alone in the Universe.
Mm-hmm.
Check this out.
Almost 60 years after Roswell, the mystery of what crashed in the deserts of New Mexico remains a secret. The government's official stance about the existence of UFOs has always been denial. Eyewitnesses have come and gone. Project Blue Book, the UFO study program of the U.S. Air Force, has gone out of business. But many questions remain. Researchers and private investigators continue to follow every lead in hopes that someday the truth will be revealed. Newly leaked classified government documents may be the first real evidence to shed light on this never-ending story.
Very cool. And like I said, I've watched it. It's pretty interesting. It's basically they go into the Majestic 12, or the secret group that was assembled by the president to go in and investigate these UFOs and UFO crashes. All these documents, you follow these trails, and they show that, you know, the government always has and still is a well-orchestrated plan in place to kind of discredit any UFO sightings and aliens and things like that. They're ongoing. They're trying. Just like I mentioned in the segment in the beginning, it's swamp gas and things like that. It's preposterous. If you're interested in things like this, I suggest you go over to Gaia.com and sign up. There's plans over there. There's several different ones. I think it's about $9.95 a month. But if you sign up now, the first month is only 99 cents. And like I said, man, there's tons of documentaries on there. I've watched several. The Deep Space series, that's my favorite so far that I found. It's about 11-part series right now. I think it's still going. The Dark Alliance and stuff, talking about this anti-gravitic technology that the Germans were using and their secret plan when they, Project Paperclip, when they came over here and worked for us, Wernher von Braun and all that. And there's all these claims showing that our scientists and their scientists were working on building these craft. And I don't think there's any doubt that some of that stuff actually happened. There's other documentaries on there that are pretty cool about moon bases, about bases on Mars. Very interesting. I also watched one about fairies and fae folk in like New Zealand. I don't know. I love that kind of stuff. I don't watch normal television that much. If I do, it's just hockey games or like a fight or something like that. Yeah. Most of the time, I'm watching Netflix, Hulu. I watch Showtime and HBO Now.
And then Gaia. And now I watch just Gaia. Reeling through that.
Yeah. And that's what I do. Do you have anything over there that you like to watch?
Man, well, like I told you, and we've talked to everybody here lately. The Gaia thing, it's something that it was an untapped resource for me. And that's what I enjoy the most about it, is because if I don't keep up with the documentaries, I get left in the dust, because this fool sitting across the table from me, that's all he does, is he's just like, he just goes nuts, you know? So he's constantly sending me text messages. You got to check this one out. You got to check that one out. So I'm like, okay. And I've got a list of them in my list, and I'm like, I got to catch up. I got to catch up. And then he'll call me in the next day. Did you watch it? I'm like, no, I did this other one. So now in Gaia, it's one of those deals. You check this out? Yeah, check that out. You check this out? No, I checked this one out. And it's just back and forth. That's what I appreciate, is having, it's almost like what podcasts are good for. Because it used to not be this way. You used to not be able to find what you wanted to watch or what you wanted to hear, just things like that. And now it seems like we can easily go down whatever thread and rabbit hole we want to. If you don't want to watch that stuff, you don't have to. You have a choice.
Yeah.
And I think I love it. This is the best time. This is for anyone that loves to question things and loves to question mystery and learn about fringe topics, this is the greatest time in the human race to learn and to just keep up with all this fun, entertaining stuff, because there's so many shows to listen to, so many shows to watch.
I agree with
you. It's great. I love it.
Real quick, also, if you'd like to send your story to us, please feel free to do so. You can email the show at expandedperspectives@yahoo.com, or you can call and leave a message, 817-945-3828, and I have to send out a big apology to everybody out there. I'm an idiot. For weeks.
You're preaching to the choir. They know this now, dum-dum.
for a while, you know, we were always getting messages on there, and then all of a sudden, blim, blam, nothing. No messages at all. I'm like, what's going on here? I realized that some point a couple weeks ago, when we were about to do an interview, I turned off the voicemail to our Skype phone number, and that's why we haven't been getting any messages. Complete oversight. Because I haven't tested it myself. I'm like, it's not working. What's going on? And when I turned it back on, it's working. So if you've tried to leave a message and were unable to, I apologize. I apologize. That was me. A large oversight. I'm an idiot. But now you can. So it's on if you want to leave a message. 817-945-3828.
Feel free to call and tell him how big of an idiot he is, folks.
Yeah, that's okay. I'm okay with that.
We tell y'all all the time that we're stupid. Yeah. We don't know how this stuff works. We tell everybody that. They send us messages and all that. No, it's for real. We don't know. And now you're finally grasping the fact. We don't know. We just do all this and it comes out like this. And that's just like, be like a really good chef. Really good. How do you cook that? I just put it in the oven. That's all it was.
Yeah.
That's it. That's it. So, yeah.
You got any big plans for the week?
Dude, I've got so much work to do this week because...
The next week is Thanksgiving and birthday.
Don't remind me of that.
And Luke's birthday.
Right. And my nephew and Blake's.
Yeah.
I mean, we're just stacking them in. I've got so much stuff I have to get done this week because I have to be off work next Monday with my mother. I've got to take her back in for another deal with her doctor. Well, but that takes all day. Yeah. And then I've only got 2 days, 3 days. I got to get all this other stuff crammed in. From this point forward, it's go time until December. Yeah. So, yeah, this is going to be some work. I mean, I've got a lot of grinding to do. And like I told you, I'm mad was I with all that new equipment. And I was about to go crazy. But that's going to help me out. What about you? What do y'all got going on?
I'm with you. I've got a lot of work. I got to get it done this week because of all the events coming up. So I'm going to be hard at it. For you elite members, we'll be speaking to you again on Thursday. For everybody else, we'll talk to you again on next Monday. I'm Kyle Filson. He's Cam Hill.
Peace, y'all.
Messages. Hey Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week? Hey Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today. Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.